Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley, your host for the programme, which every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio, as part of Faith Explored, brings you conversations between Christians and non-Christians. And whether you're listening this Saturday afternoon or somewhere around the world at a different time in the week via the podcast, you're very welcome along. And we're going to be hearing an interesting conversation with an agnostic today. The kind of conversation you might have if you're a Christian with a non-Christian of some kind. And we're going to be helping you to think through how to do those conversations better at this year's Unbelievable conference. If you can come along on Saturday, the 2nd of July, to our conference in central London, then you'll be finding how to discover your inner evangelist. Some really practical advice this year, as well as introducing you to some of those arguments and issues that you might want to raise with someone who is a skeptic about Christianity. Loads of great speakers, great ticketing options, free DVD, all available from the website. If you can go there and look at the options, see if you can come along. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016. Going to be a great day in central London on Saturday, the 2nd of July. Later on today, on the profile, you're going to be hearing a couple of people. I'll be in conversation with Pastor Stefan, a Lebanese pastor. We're actually using an assumed name because of the nature of his work. He's seeing many Muslims come to Christ because of the refugee crisis going on literally on his doorstep. And then you'll hear a replay of a recent conversation that was had with the Archbishop of Canterbury this last week, Justin Welby. Look out for that between 4 and 5 on the profile. For the moment, let's get into today's discussion. Well, I'm really looking forward to today's programme as we ask why Mike can't believe. And the Mike in question is Mike Rand. He's been a listener of Unbelievable for several years and he describes himself as a classic agnostic. He finds himself drawn to aspects of Christian faith but has never been able to find satisfactory answers to some key issues such as the question of original sin and whether Jesus is the only way to God. Well, as a retired detective inspector, evidence and a rational case for belief are of prime importance to him. So he's going to be in conversation today with our Christian guest, David Robertson. Well known to Unbelievable listeners, of course, he's the moderator of the Free Church of Scotland, a speaker, author, and director of the Solas Centre for Public Christianity in Dundee, Scotland, where he pastors at St. Peter's Free Church. So I'm really looking forward to today's questions. We'll be seeing if David can shed any light on any of Mike's questions today as we have this open-ended dialogue on why Mike can't believe. Gentlemen, welcome both to Unbelievable.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you, Justin.
It's great to have you both. David, we'll come to you in a moment. Mike, though, first time on the show, though, you've been listening for years, I think, haven't you?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I picked you up probably about 3 or 4 years ago from iTunes off of the podcasts. And I've listened to most of your back catalogue that's available, and I've been a fan for some time.
So. You must be sick of the sound of my voice by now.
No, it's very strange to actually see you here in the flesh, as it were.
Well, I'm really glad we were able to connect, and you took the opportunity to get in touch and just explain a little bit to me of your backstory, which is always fun to hear, listeners. Do you want to just give us the potted version?
Sure. Well, basically, I'm now 59 years of age, and as a lad, as a young boy, I went to a Methodist church for Sunday school. That was until I found football. and the big match and Brian Moore, and then
Sunday school were thereafter relegated.
It was. It faded away somewhat. Okay. But so my family were not particularly religious. Certainly, I don't come from a Christian background at all. My mother really didn't speak about religion, and my father, towards the end of his life, did go to church, but I tend to think he was perhaps covering the odds in some respect.
That just in case.
Just in case. Right. He tended to go on a regular basis. It did give him some comfort, to be fair to him. So, so I don't really come from a strong Christian background. I'm an ex-serving police officer, as you said. I worked in Hertfordshire and in Dorset, attaining the rank of detective inspector in the end by the time I retired. I'm now fully retired. They were great times. But during that particular phase, I suppose, like everything, the culture was very much a drinking culture. And that, in fact, led to probably quite a serious problem with alcohol.
Okay.
A very good friend of mine took me to a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous, which are a fantastic organisation. And from the very first moment I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a small room down in the west of Dorset, which is actually a Quaker-owned room. And there was a very strong presence and feeling within that room.
Something you couldn't quite put your finger on.
To this day, I've never been able to put my finger on it. But it changed me. Okay. There's no doubt it changed me. When I got home, my wife said to me, well, you even look different. She couldn't explain it. And I suppose I class that as a spiritual experience. I really feel as if I found God at that moment. And a lot of people, the people who do the best out of Alcoholics Anonymous, tend to find some kind of power.
A spiritual experience.
Some sort of spiritual experience. Yeah, the people who really get it and stay sober. And I've been sober now for 18 years, which I'm very grateful for. So that really started my, if you like, search towards God and Christianity. The problem I've found is that I can't seem to recreate or find that same experience through the Christian church.
Okay.
My wife, a few years ago, probably talking about 10, 15 years ago now, went on an Alpha course. And she kept coming back to me and saying, well, today we dealt with various issues. And I said, well, did you ask a question about this? And she said, oh, no, I didn't think of that. Or did you ask a question about that? In fact, I've got quite a good story. I hope this is okay.
But, go ahead.
Sure,
we'll have heard worse.
Well, she's very happy for me to tell you this one.
But go ahead.
We were talking, one of the issues that came up was the resurrection. And when she got home, I said to her, well, just tell me something. Why is it that when Jesus was resurrected, the people he saw, everybody who saw him when they first met him, didn't recognize him? And being an ex-police officer, I think it's an identification issue.
Right.
Is there a chance it's the wrong man?
Okay.
And she said, well, perhaps he shaved his beard off.
it's a theory.
And I said, oh, so he's arrived in heaven and he said to God, can I just have a wash and a brush up? Before? And she said, well, Robert Powell did. But of course, then I had to explain that Robert Powell wasn't the real Jesus. So the long and the short of it is I needed to do the Alpha course myself. And I went on the Alpha course via the church in Weymouth. And it was great. I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved the people. I loved the chat. The people were wonderful. But once again, I came away with more questions, I think, than answers.
And you never quite got that experience again?
No.
That was obviously so profound for you 18 years before.
Yeah, and every time I go to a church, I find myself sitting there, and they start to read something like the creeds, and I think, no, that can't. Can that be right? Is that right?
Right.
And I think perhaps there's just something in me that just can't commit to walking over that doorstep.
That's really interesting, and we'll hear more about your story as the programme progresses. Let's hear from you now, David. Nice to have you back in the studio. It's been a little while.
It's lovely to be back with Mike. I'll tell you this straight away. I'm going to love this because I think that Mike's story is indicative. You could say why Mike can't believe. I would say why 50% of the British population can't believe.
Mike is a stand-in for many people.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think his viewpoint is there's not. Well, there are people who are antagonistic. And then there are people who totally believe it. But there's a huge number of people who go, yeah, but.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's what we're dealing with today. Yeah. So great. Okay. Great to be back for that.
Well, I know you guys have had a quick chance to meet each other before the show, just outside the studio. But I think this will be a really interesting conversation for us to have. You're always provoking conversations of one kind or another, David. Your blog's really been taking off, I hear, recently, the Wee Flea blog. You've been writing for us as well, the Premier Christianity magazine blog. In fact, the last one you did for us on and what's his name? The TV presenter.
Dan
Walker. And, yeah. and that controversy did amazingly well. And you've just written recently as well on the recent spate of celebrity deaths and what that might mean the way our culture deals with it. You're interested in sort of poking at the cultural issues.
Well, I am. I'm Mike in reverse, almost. In that, you know, everywhere I go, I ask questions, and I like looking at the culture and asking questions. And do you know, I hated the idea of a blog.
Mm.
I only did it. Somebody once I started it, one of my friends wrote, "Oh no, what's happened? What have we done?" That's like putting a match into a room full of dynamite. But I just wrote for myself. I didn't write for anybody else. I just wrote thinking out loud. And that's a very dangerous thing to do. And I'm glad you're here to edit this program because that's what I do. And the thing is, a lot of it does seem to resonate. And I think you reach a sort of critical mass where there are people who read and then pass on.
Mm.
And so I think that's what's been happening. But, yeah. I mean, it's been fantastic to see the interest. And it's not so much... I mean, there are people who get really wound up by stuff I say. I can't understand because it's all perfectly reasonable.
Whenever I see you replying to someone on Twitter, I just know that if I trace that back, there'll be about 50 responses. Yeah, some kind of argument going on.
That's right. But, I mean, I'm an equal opportunity offender because there are Christians and non-Christians
who hate you
alike
as well.
Yeah, so that's...
There you go. Well, look, it's lovely to have you back, and I always enjoy the interactions. Mike, obviously, you've heard David a number of times, I'm sure, in years.
It's very formidable, isn't it? I was very nervous.
I don't see this as a sort of antagonistic debate.
No,
I think we're looking for, I'm sure, just to discuss your story, and we'll get to what we can in terms of some of these questions and objections you have to Christian faith. If you're listening and you'd like to respond to anything you hear on today's show, you can, of course, get in touch via the usual methods. Email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/unbelievablejb, or follow me on Twitter @unbelievablejb. Send me your thoughts those ways, and I look forward to hearing them. Don't forget you can find today's programme and lots of links to other interesting stuff from the Unbelievable website. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So today we're asking why Mike can't quite believe. Mike Rand is a listener of Unbelievable, has been for several years, describes himself as a classic agnostic, finds himself drawn to some aspects of Christian faith, but never been able to find satisfactory answer to some key issues, such as original sin and whether Jesus is the only way to God. So he's talking to David Robertson today on the programme, our Christian guest. So Mike, just to kind of dig in a little bit as we start up, why have you pursued Christianity, I suppose, is one question. And what do you find attractive about Christianity, if there are things that sort of strike you as...
I suppose it basically comes from the background that I originated from mm-hmm. the Methodist Sunday school, probably, has drawn me towards it. Although I have read quite a bit in relation to Buddhism and other type of religions. I have mm-hmm. looked into those. But I do feel drawn towards the Christian religion. I think that I sort of sense that you get to a certain age... and materialistic gains become less important.
Mm-hmm.
And you suddenly realise that you can't have real happiness just by materialistic life alone. Or you probably can, but in my particular case, I don't think that I can have a real happiness just through materialistic gains. I feel that there's something spiritual in all of us that sometimes needs to be brought out and to get to be really, really happy in life.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever find yourself praying or anything like that? Do you ever find yourself trying to commune with something beyond this world?
Yeah,
world?
Yeah, I do. On quite a regular basis, on a personal level, I do. I mean, you can find spirituality in all sorts of different arenas. I mean, I've been to Wells Cathedral recently for some music.
Mm.
And I tell you what, there's nothing more spiritual than sitting there, especially at Christmas time with the candles there. A candlelit service in Wells Cathedral. Listening to classical music played was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful, without any words being said, actually.
So some people describe that as a transcendent experience, but many atheists I meet also say, but ultimately it boils down to a sort of an emotional experience. It can all be explained.
Yes.
Physically. I mean, do you not quite buy that? What's your feeling?
I suppose it could, but I just... The drive is so strong that you begin to feel in yourself, you know, it's something that certainly you need to investigate further and look at further. And just to see where it will lead you on the journey, as it were. So.
Any thoughts so far, David, on this?
Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, preempt Mike a little bit just to say, you know, I'd love to hear some of the questions that you have with that. But I think what you're saying so far is spot on. I mean, I've just come here from the National Gallery. I regard that as a spiritual experience. Yes. I was just joyous in front of some of these paintings because I see all things as, you know, being created by God and so on. I do think there is something within us that calls out in that way, which can't be explained just physically. And I think the experience that you had at AA, which is, I'll warn you in advance, I want to ask you about that later on as well. I think that's fascinating and very, very interesting. C.S. Lewis once said that we have an appetite for sex because there's such a thing as sex. We have an appetite for food because there's such a thing as food. And we have an appetite for God because, and you complete the rest of the equation. And I think that's true. I think that there is a longing and a spiritual thirst and hunger. I think you can make that so general it becomes meaningless. So what I'm interested in is specifics. And I think that Jesus comes to give us the living water. Jesus comes to give us that life. So I'd like to ask you and be interested in what you're thinking, your thought is about Jesus. Oh, can I just say something about the identification issue?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Now, this is what I would have said to you. Now, you're the policeman, so I'm...
did he shave his beard off? Yeah.
This is your territory. Yes. But it strikes me that if you're not expecting to see someone, you won't see them. In other words, if someone was dead, I knew that they were dead, and I bumped into them, because I'm not expecting to see them, that's a big psychological conditioner to prevent me seeing them. It's like when someone is speaking and they make a mistake, but I've anticipated the words they're going to say. I just put those words in. So I think there are two reasons for people not recognizing Jesus. Number one, I'm sure, is the psychological one. He's dead. So, I mean, no way. And number two is he did have a different body as well. So there may have been aspects of it that were kind of otherworldly.
The most interesting example, I suppose, is the Road to Emmaus story, where people spend a whole journey talking and looking at scriptures with this man, and only when he breaks the bread, they see him. Yeah. So it sounds like there's something spiritual going on as well as the physical person that they're walking with.
Well, I think so, but I do think that you could be in a situation, and I mean, we don't know how close these particular disciples were, but you could be in a situation where you must have come across people whose reasoning has been so damaged by grief and shock that they can't even put two and two together.
Well, that's possible, but I think it's difficult to understand. I think this is the difficulty to understand how somebody who's walking on the road next to somebody that they knew so well doesn't recognise them. And my thoughts, the only way that I could reconcile that thought would be that the return of Jesus was not a physical return, but was some form of vision, spiritual return. That I could almost understand, although once again we're drifting away from the laws of nature. But that makes more sense than not recognizing him. To me, it's a real problem with the resurrection as a physical resurrection because people didn't recognize him.
See, I would go almost the opposite way, because I would say that physical apparitions and so on. I mean, for example, this is true. I mean, people believe this or not. We just had an interview in my church with my elders with a lady from Thailand who had nothing to do with Christianity whatsoever. And a few weeks ago, she woke up and there was a presence in her room, a physical presence, she thought. It was a man, and she described, and she had this experience. I'll not go into the details of it. But as a result, she started reading her Bible, and then she came along to church, and she's actually going to be baptized next Sunday. Now, she says, absolutely, in Thailand, we're used to seeing ghosts. And, you know, it was very interesting, her cultural explanation of that. I think in first century Israel, the whole point of the gospel accounts is, you know, like Jesus eating broiled fish. Fish. Ghosts don't eat broiled fish. You know, it's the detail. It's the little details. Again, as a policeman, you must know that. It's the little details in people's testimony that give substance to the major stories. And I think it's the little details that give substance. I have no difficulty in two people overcome by grief. We don't know how well they knew Jesus, walking along a road. he may well have had, you know, a hood or whatever, and talking to them. But it was only when they went in, sat down, and they broke the bread that suddenly went, wait a minute, this is who he is. And for me, what I know of humanity and what I know of how grief distorts a mind, I have no qualms with that at all, no difficulty.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder if those stories, the Gospels are written around to prove that the breaking of the bread and the fish was purely an additional story, if you like, to prove that the body wasn't just a vision, but was actually whole. Do you think the writers wrote that as an indication that the risen Jesus was physical?
No, because I think they wrote it because it happened and it indicates that Jesus was physical. I don't think they wrote it for that reason, because if you're inventing something, well, first of all, you're going to be in trouble because you're going to die for a lie. But secondly, you're making your religion very difficult for other people to believe. So if you're going to invent a religion to make money or for your own psychological comfort or whatever reason, don't make it so unbelievable. I mean, good plug for the program, but you know. But I mean, you know, people like Christopher Hitchens, physical resurrections were 10 a penny. No, they weren't. Paul was speaking in Athens, and he was getting on fine, talking about creation, talking about other stuff, even talking about judgment. It was only when he spoke about the resurrection that people said, oh, no, we're out of here. This is unbelievable. We're done. And I think that if they were kind of politically astute, they would have pushed that to the side, but they made it a main thing. And I think the only explanation they could have made it a main thing is because it was true.
Let's move just beyond this, because the question I think that David had originally was what do you make of Jesus?
Of Jesus. Yeah,
and be interested in your response to that, Mike.
My instincts are, and having read quite a bit recently, I tend to think that Jesus isn't I don't believe he's the Son of God. Mm-hmm. I think Jesus was probably the most spirit-filled, Holy Spirit-filled man who ever lived. I think he was filled with the Holy Spirit. If from the experiences that I've had with the feelings that I've encountered, but I don't believe that he was the Son of God.
Why not?
Because I find it very, very difficult to believe in virgin births. Because virgin births don't happen. They certainly don't happen in this age. They may well have been reported as happening back in first century Palestine. I think there were previous occasions where virgin births were reported.
Sorry, what's a virgin birth? Just I'm going to see you with this one.
Yeah, that's
you know,
fine.
You're the detective, so I'm going to, you know. But I mean, when you say virgin birth,
well,
what
the story
mean?
Of the virgin birth, sort of Mary and the virgin birth.
Yeah. So, but the virgin birth occurs. It's someone giving birth without having sex.
Yes.
Yeah. But that does happen today.
Oh, what, from artificial insemination?
Yes.
Yeah, but I don't think they did that in first century Palestine.
No, they didn't. Well, actually, we don't know that they didn't. They could well have done. Okay. I'm sure that's been going on for quite a long time in different things. But the point is, if we as human beings can do that, why would it be impossible for an almighty God to create within the womb in that way?
It just seems to breach all the laws of nature.
It does. That's the point.
And in first century Palestine, I think that's very unlikely.
I guess the point that you're making, David, is that we call it a miracle because it does, in a sense,
breach the laws of nature.
The laws of nature. Yes. That's the definition of a miracle.
Well, I think you have to say to yourself, do you believe in miracles?
Yeah. Mm.
And personally, I don't. And I find it very... Well, they don't say I don't because I've got an open mind.
Yeah. Right.
I find it difficult to believe in miracles.
Okay. But that's wise. I mean, you'll get lots and lots of Christians who go, yeah, I believe in miracles. And I expect a miracle. And people will even say, phone in for a miracle, or, you know, give me $20 and you'll get a miracle. And say, oh, grow up, guys. Yeah. You know, don't be daft. Miracles, by definition, are rare, extremely rare. And they are against the law of nature. They're not just, like I might say, my teenage daughter, it's a miracle she got out of bed this morning. You know, no. Yeah. It's a miracle that you're a Watford fan.
Yes, I am.
It's a miracle that
Sorry
Watford.
About everybody.
Yeah. I mean, could Watford turn into Leicester? I mean,
they could do. See, I wish they would.
Leicester's almost a miracle. You know, I mean,
well,
and you know, so we don't use miracle in that sense. We use miracle to say that it's a direct intervention by God, overturning His own rules, if you like. And by definition, therefore, it's very rare. The Bible's not full of miracles. It's only the periods of Moses, Elijah and Elisha, and Jesus and the apostles. And those are actually very small periods.
Hmm. I mean, if there was a God, do you acknowledge that it's plausible that that God could, you know, change the, you know, set aside the laws of nature that he has put in place in order to feed in a new event in the form of a miracle, a virgin birth?
With an open mind, you have to say yes. It's, I mean, open mind, it is possible. But it just seems so unlikely that they picked this particular period of time to do that.
Why this particular period of time?
Well, you have to say to yourself, my understanding is we've evolved over millions and millions of years. Mm-hmm. Why would a God wait until first century Palestine to send his son at that particular moment?
David? Okay. That's the Apostle Paul answers that one. He anticipated your question. He
said, good.
In Galatians, he said, at just the right time, God sent his son. Now, I would dispute the millions and millions of years, but let's not go down that particular rabbit hole. Even accepting the theory of evolution, humanity may be 100,000. That's a kind of little bit more of a technical detail. Why precisely at that point did God send his son? I think from the beginning, there's a promise of his son being sent. I think he sent his word. I think he sent his spirit. You've talked about the Holy Spirit very interestingly. Who, for someone who says that he's not a theist, that's interesting because the Holy Spirit was also God. But I think there was kind of leading up to this. And then Jesus comes at a time when there was a common language in the whole of Southern Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, Greek as the kind of lingua franca, if that doesn't mix things up too much. There was the Roman Empire and the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. There was a whole bunch of other stuff going on that historically it kind of look. You look at it and you go, oh, I can see how this works. And you can see how it worked because the Christian church spread phenomenally. And nobody would have, I mean, there was.
Are you saying that if it had happened a couple of centuries earlier, it wouldn't have had the capacity, the same impact because of the, there wouldn't have been that.
Yeah,
exactly. Factors.
I think God actually normally uses means. And the means there were the Roman Empire, the Greeks, the state of the Jewish nation, and so on. And for me, that's not a problem. I wrote a chapter on miracles, and I described your position as being the most honest position. Because G.K. Chesterton says that atheists have a doctrine that miracles cannot happen. Mm. It's a doctrine that therefore, and the minute anyone talks about it cannot be. So we're discussing a supernatural God. He can't exist because miracles can't happen. And, you know, and you just go round and round and round in circles. Now, you're not in that position, which I think is the most reasonable position that I know of.
Just briefly, just before we have to go to our first break, what do you make of David's argument that maybe it was just the right time? Maybe that was the first moment really in history where a movement like Christianity could spread and develop and so on.
I just find it very difficult because I would advocate that the Earth is millions of years old and various creatures creatures have come before that.
Yeah.
Are they God's creatures as well? I presume they are. I presume the whole world has been God's creatures. Why does he wait until you get to a certain stage to suddenly send the sun to sort of... And the other thing that has always puzzled me, and this will be... I'm quite interested to see what you say about this. Why is it that God doesn't prove to us that he's there? I mean, question, I know.
We're opening up lots of cans of worms simultaneously here. Let's go to our break and we'll see what David has to say in response. A really interesting discussion today. Why Mike Can't Believe. Mike Rand joins me in studio here. He's been a listener of Unbelievable for several years. He's an interested agnostic, had a spiritual experience several years back, but says he's never quite been able to replicate it or convince himself that Christianity has the truth either. David Robertson, our Christian guest, is in conversation with him today, and I hope you'll continue with us in the next part of today's edition of Unbelievable.
If you've ever found yourself cornered by a skeptic who is intent on challenging your faith, and you've thought, how can I answer, or what do I say, let the Christian Thinkers Society help. mission is to teach Christians to become thinkers and thinkers to become Christians. We train believers to understand the core truths of their faith and how to demonstrate why Christianity makes sense. Find us at this year's Unbelievable, the conference. And for Jeremiah J. Johnson's new book, Unanswered, visit christianthinkers.com and find the answers you need.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. Unbelievable is the place where Christians and non-Christians get together for dialogue and debate. Sometimes it's with heavyweight scholars, physicists, scientists, that kind of thing. Sometimes it's just with regular Joes, and I don't know if that, I hope that doesn't sound bad, Mike, but
no,
but Mike Rand joins me in studio today, and he's a listener of Unbelievable. He happened across the programme several years ago, has listened to a lot of the back catalogue. Maybe you're a similar person who downloads it week in, week out. Anyway, he's ended up here in the Unbelievable studio to have a conversation with David Robertson, well-known to Unbelievable listeners. He's a moderator of the Free Church of Scotland. You've gone up in the world since you first came on this programme, actually, David, haven't you? But
That's about to end, by the way.
Oh, okay.
So I'm an ordinary Joe as well. I'm also a listener, by the way, of Unbelievable.
Well,
I got it on my podcast.
Absolutely.
Can't listen to you on a Saturday because you come in the holy hour.
No.
Football.
I see. Well,
I'm with Mike on this one.
In any case, it's great to have you both here, guys, in the studio. We're asking why Mike can't quite believe, and addressing some of his questions, doubts about Christian faith, and seeing whether David can shed any light on them. If you want to get in touch, as usual, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the way to do that, via email. You can send me a tweet, you can get in touch via Facebook as well. All the links available from the Unbelievable webpage, where you can download today's programme, subscribe to the podcast just like these guys do. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. So let's continue as we get into the rest of this conversation. So you were just saying towards the end of that last part, Mike, that you have issues over miracles. There was this question mark over whether Jesus, you know, came too late in the day. You know, there were lots of animals and stuff happening before 2,000 years ago. And then on top of that, you added this question mark over, well, what was the last question?
Proof,
yeah.
Because, well,
why doesn't God just make it absolutely plain?
Well, why doesn't just God just send us such a sign that everybody would believe?
Yeah.
And there would never be any question about it.
Please let me have both of these.
Okay, all right.
Can I do that? I'm not being like a politician and delaying here while think of something. But can I do the millions of creatures,
yes,
or the creatures being around for? Yeah. I mean, I do believe the Earth is millions of years old.
Okay.
I'm sorry to Unbelievable listeners who get upset at that, but I mean, I do. To me, the evidence seems to be that, and I don't think the Bible says anything about the age of the Earth. But in terms of humans and other animals, I think we're animals, but we're not just animals. I think there's a fundamental difference between us and animals, and it's best described, I think, in Genesis, where it says that God breathed his spirit into mankind, and man became a living being. And I think that that means a spiritual being. And I think that is the difference between us. When we say we're made in the image of God, it's not that God looks like a human, and that, you know, cats and dogs are not. I think that they are his creatures, but we are made in his image. We have this ability to reason, to think, to communicate, the whole question of morality, to choose between right and wrong. You are a policeman. You would never take an animal to court because it's been immoral. And I think that indicates a fundamental distinction. Now, some people will say that's a distinction that's come about through an evolutionary process.
I was just going to say the same thing. Is that not just a normal evolutionary? Suddenly we became self-conscious beings as opposed to conscious beings.
Well, the interesting thing about that is suddenly we became.
Is it suddenly? We don't know, do we?
How does a non-conscious being become a conscious being?
Well, how does anything evolve? We don't know, do we?
Well, you see, but that's the point. The point is that people are putting an enormous amount of faith in what I call science of the gaps. We don't know, but it just must have been, because everything comes from evolution. I would argue, even assuming that the whole theory of evolution is true, it's a theory of the development of biological life. But you came into this discussion saying there's got to be more than material, and there is. And I think that's what we're discussing. And I think that explanation is seen in that. The proof one, Do you want to come back on that, or do I?
Well, yeah, please.
Please,
yeah,
go back with that. Come back with that.
So what was the question you had
the question
over
is,
proof?
God is all. If God is all powerful, why doesn't he show himself to us now in such a way, not just as an individual, but as a world, to bring the world into some sort of peace? Because there's a lot of problems within the world. Some of it caused by fanatical religion.
Yeah.
Why doesn't God just come forward and say,
I am
believe.
Here.
I'm here, believe.
And sort stuff out.
Sort yourself out. Yeah.
I think that when you're done here, go home and read John chapter 1, because that says he did, and he has. I would argue he has. Now, the trouble is that the presupposition, I think, with your question almost seems to be, why doesn't God show himself in such a way that every human being would be compelled to believe?
Yes.
My argument against that would be, if we were compelled to believe, we would cease to be human. In other words, we would be like programmed robots. I mean, again, I mean, I'm sorry, I keep referring to your career, but I'm fascinated.
That's all right. No, you're right.
I'm fascinated by it. Wouldn't it be great if, as a policeman, you could pray and God showed you who was guilty and everyone else in the jury became instantly convinced they were guilty because, you know, that's just the way it was. There's no choice. I mean, in the world in which we live, you have to find evidence, you have to work things out, and you have to convince people of it and look for that. And yet, I'm sure you've had cases where the evidence to you seemed overwhelming, and yet people rejected it.
Yeah, very much so.
You know, why did they reject it? I mean, you've presented them with the evidence, and it's overwhelming, and yet they've still rejected it. And a lot of it can be personal bias, prejudice, stupidity, so many different things. I think that God... I hope this doesn't sound blasphemous or offensive to any of the listeners. I think God has done his best. And what I mean by that is, I think he's presented us with the greatest proof while still preserving our human integrity and freedom to think and work things out for ourselves. So to me, you know, people like to argue about, you know, science and all this. And I like to argue about it too. I have to admit, Justin knows that. But for me, everything focuses on Jesus.
I mean, I've heard it described, David, I don't know if you'd go with this, that God wants us to choose to love him, not just that we will have to believe in him because he's sort of given us ironclad copper bottom proof that's simply undeniable.
Well, there's another presupposition there as well, I think, tied in, Mike, and maybe please forgive me if I'm misunderstanding this, and please come back on me on this one. It seems to me that you're presupposing that most people are either intelligent enough or decent enough or good enough that if they were presented with the evidence, they would believe it.
I think it must be possible for God to do something in such a way that it's undoubtedly true and that everybody would believe.
What do you think that might be?
I've got no idea. I've got no idea what God looks like.
I've had this interesting conversation sometimes with atheists, certain atheists who come in my studio, and when they say something similar, when I say, well, what would convince you? Jesus appearing in front of you, saying, I am the only way. And they say, well, that could just be a hallucination.
Right.
So I can't actually, no, that wouldn't be enough. God spelling it out in the stars.
Right.
No, alien technology,
I'm taking your point.
Races. It's almost like you could always, what would count as evidence?
Almost as if God had his own TV show, we probably might believe it. But that's a bit flippant. I don't mean it to be. But we do need, it just strikes me that there must be some way.
Right.
Because we have so much evilness within the world, surely there must be a way that God could actually stop it once and for all. Yes, there is.
And the way to do that is to destroy the world.
Right, no, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, exactly. So now we've got a dilemma. How does God stop the evil in the world without destroying it?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is, and this is a question I think where you'll probably want to bring up, the whole question of atonement.
Yes, very much so.
So we'll come on to that when you're ready. But I think the answer to that is that he does it in such a way. I think he kills, again, any Christians who are particularly sensitive, forgive me for... This sounding flippant, but kills like three birds with one stone, because the one is, how does he reveal himself to us? And it's a Sunday school story. Maybe you got it in Methodist Sunday school. I don't know, but it's you know, there's a man walking along with his son, and they come across an ant heap that's about to be run over by a tractor or something. And the son says, "Dad, you have to go and warn them." "Well, how can I do that?" "Well, you have to become an ant, obviously."
Right.
Well, I think Jesus became a human being. And I think that you want to know, Hebrews 1 says basically, you want to know what God is like, you look at Jesus. Mm. So I think that, you know, the spiritual side of it, and everything's tied in with that as well.
Could that not just be because he's God-filled rather than the Son of God?
Well, the God-filled stuff would work really, really well if it wasn't for what he said, which was that he was the Son of God. So if he's God-filled and telling lies or deluded, I'm not going to trust somebody like that. And to me, there's no problem. And I tell you, one of the great things about the Son of God, basically, if there was God and there was nothing else, you say God is love. Well, who did he love? But if there's the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, one God, three persons, which is like, wow, that's beyond my comprehension. Well, so what? I believe in things that are beyond my comprehension. You know, physics is beyond my... Listen, the Scottish football team is beyond my comprehension. I still believe in them. You know, so, you know, the fact that it's beyond my comprehension doesn't matter. The important thing is that God is love, because the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, you know, live in a fellowship of love. And that gets communicated through Christ to us, which is the most wonderful thing. So I think the ultimate proof is Jesus Christ. I think that the kind of proof which you seem to be asking for either presupposes that human beings will just accept it, doesn't accept that there are people who will reject it no matter what.
Right.
I mean, I've been showing to people for many, many years on this program that just how wonderful and nice I am. And there are people who still don't believe it. But I proved
it. Some strange reason.
I proved it to them. You know, but I mean, the criteria of proof is very difficult. I mean, ultimately, and I'm not saying this about you, by the way, but some of my more hardened atheist friends have a criteria of proof, which means that nothing could ever be proved.
What do you think? I mean, you've heard David say maybe God's got good reasons for not making his, us blatantly aware of his presence, that there's this sense in which we...
I tend to not like that, because that's almost like a test.
Well, maybe it is.
Is that how you see it?
I don't know.
I mean,
what do you
that's
think,
almost then? Like, well, let me see what you're going to do. And that's supposing that you've got a God who's actually directing you all the time. Mm. That whole... This is another concept. This is another question, actually. I find it very difficult to believe that there's... we've gone away from the three-tier God where there's a God sat in heaven and we've gone down to hell. I think those days are gone. I don't know if you would agree with that. But the three-tier universe seemed to me to have gone out many years ago with space travel and the rest of it, that God isn't actually physically sat there with a ledger looking at who's good and who's bad. I think the only way it works is for God to work, if it does work, is for God to work through you in how you behave. That I think that's possible, i.e. conscience, that we've all got to stages where we've gone to do something and thought, oh, I'm not doing that because that would be wrong. The moral questions, if you like. And I think that's the only way that I can see that God could actually work through you is through your conscience, which I think may well be some form of, in my own mind, I think maybe some form of God. But I don't think there's somebody that at the end of your days is sat there with a ledger saying, you did this or you did something wrong at that time.
Wow. Okay. That's brilliant. I mean, you're opening up so many doors. It's like this, you know, Christmas advent calendar that you open up five windows at once.
Are you glad I came now?
David's in the apologist version of Disneyland.
All right. Oh, right. Okay.
Well,
okay.
I mean, the conscience thing, for example, the Bible would agree with you, because Romans 2 talks about how God's law is written on our hearts. For those who don't have the law written in his word, it's written on our hearts. And, you know, the evolutionary explanation of that is, say, you know, conscience has evolved. It's an evolutionary throwback. Dawkins would call it a blessed Darwinian mistake, which I think the concepts of good and evil is a mistake. That's quite ugly, actually. So, but the Bible would agree with you that conscience is God speaking to us in that sense. Now, our consciences can be warped, and there are all kinds of problems with that, but I think you're on the right track with that. The three-tier universe, I'm not convinced that Christians ever believed that. I don't think it's taught in the Bible. I think, interestingly, I was speaking on or preaching on the ascension of Jesus, which I hadn't really thought about. And John Calvin in the 16th century wrote a piece, said, Jesus ascended to heaven. Well, where do you think he is? Should we build a cottage for him between the planets? You know, and he was saying it's not physical in that sense. But modern science has got to a place where we now talk about multiverse. And I think there's a Christian version of multiverse. I don't think God is up there and hell is down there. I think that what we've got is different dimensions, different physical realities, and there's no reason why that couldn't be the case.
Well, I accept that, but I think that in early Christian beliefs, the idea that there was some form of heaven above where if you were good, you went to, and if you were bad, you went to hell. I haven't heard Christians talk much about hell.
Well, I'll talk about it.
No. We could be there all day.
No. I will talk about it, though, because that version of Christianity that you've just mentioned, dare I say it, is a very Western, middle-class, liberal version of Christianity. If you're good, you go to heaven. If you're bad, you go to hell. It's not the version that's ever taught in the Bible.
Right.
Because the Bible says there's no one good. So that's, you're all screwed for a start. And religious people, forget it. The Bible's saying we're all in a mess. We all need salvation. That salvation...
You're going back to original sin.
Yeah, I am, which is something that you want to go to. We're all human beings are screwed up. Now, as a policeman, you have never met a human being who's not screwed up.
No, I've met some very pleasant people over
the
years.
Yeah, but you can be screwed up unpleasant.
Well, perhaps they're hiding it better than most. Yeah. I don't know.
I have never met. I mean, it's like you do the whodunits, you know, on these murder mystery things, Agatha Christie. I mean, it's always the vicar, wasn't it?
Yeah, strange.
Strange, you know. But, you know, I mean, it's always the person you least expect. You know, there's the villain who comes in and da-da-da, the music and everything. And, you know, it can't be them. Can't be the villain, unless it's a double bluff. But it's always, you know, the sweet little old lady, except Miss Marple, you know. Mm. And that's because human beings are screwed up. I mean, we are screwed up. I don't know. I'm screwed up. You know, basically, anyone calls me names, I'm going, yep, yeah, the devil got there first. And, you know.
But is that not because we've evolved as from primates? We've moved on, haven't we, from basic primates. And some of the instincts that were there, survival instincts when we were there, as animals, are still with us today. So violence, fear, the need to survive. Mm-hmm. And really, the evilness that we talk about is, if you like, is just our primate background in a modern world.
Again, that's fascinating, because there was a study came out, and I honestly, my mind is not as good as it was. I can't remember who did it. But it was an argument in an article I read. I think it could have been the Times or the Guardian, saying that actually, naturally, human beings are evil. Naturally, we are. I'm going the other way. I'm saying, naturally, God created us good, but we've turned evil.
But I think that's the problem. We're really moving on to where we were talking about the Garden of Eden and the rest of it, is that I think that we've evolved from primates, and we have basic instincts still within us, which cause us at times to be evil because we need to survive. And what we think, we're very, very sophisticated and we're very intelligent because we've evolved into this with these huge, great brains. But deep down beneath the surface is this selfish violence. We will always, the need to survive overrides everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've only got to see it when there's a food shortage of some nature. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, there's
people's worst instincts.
People will go and buy up from supermarkets and clear the shelves so that they're okay.
Yeah.
And that's how there's that selfish gene is within us, isn't it? Somewhere along the line.
But you see, the interesting thing is, you and I would both recognize, I agree with you, we'd both recognize the same problem. The cause of it we would see as different. I would see human beings as being created as good and having gone rotten. I think what this other view says is that human beings basically were created evil and have evolved into something good, but there's a primitive instinct that remains.
Yes.
I think that as an explanation of evil, that doesn't really work. And I think, because the argument then becomes, if it's natural, why shouldn't we just do it? I've heard that argument so many times on so many issues. But basically, if natural means evil, nature red in tooth and claw and all that kind of stuff, then we're in trouble. And I don't think there's any answer to the problem of evil. It does make more sense, because with your position, you have the opposite problem of me. I have to look and say, okay, if God made human beings good, how come we're so screwed up?
Yes.
You have the problem of saying, how come we have this desire for good?
Yes.
You know, how come? I think
one of the biggest problems that the Christian church faces is the question of evil.
Yeah.
And why does God allow it? But if right from the very day one, we've developed, if you like, we've become good, as you describe, that would be a much easier explanation that it's really not God's fault, because this is how we've evolved.
I think we've become bad.
We're almost looking at it's deism, isn't it?
Deism,
God has created a world and left it.
Yeah, but if that was the case, you know, if you leave human beings to themselves, what's the book? Oh, help! My mind is now gone blank. About the kids on the island who go absolutely
Lord of the Flies.
Lord of the Flies. Yeah. Basically, you leave any human beings in a situation, they will deteriorate. And I'm saying the worst punishment that God could ever give to this nation, for example, would be to say, okay, you want to do it on your own? Do it on your own. See what happens. And I think we'd create hell on earth. I think it would be Lord of the Flies. And that, for me, is an indication, again, of one of the truths of the Bible, or one of the proofs of the Bible, is it describes human nature as it is. In fact, I've just been reading C.E.M. Jode, who was, you know, the Richard Dawkins of his day, vehement atheist.
How long ago was this?
1920s, 1930s. Mm. But after the Second World War, he became a Christian.
Right.
And incidentally, for very much the same reasons that you stated at the beginning, he became, first of all, convinced that materialism didn't answer things, and especially the problem of evil. I think the problem of evil is a bigger problem for a materialist than it is for me as a Christian.
But as we become a more secular society, and you may not agree with that, because you may say that the churches are overfilling.
No, I agree with it. Believe you me, I'm Jeremiah. I'm with you on this one.
As we become a more secular society, do you see people's behaviour getting worse, or is it that some people would always be bad and some people will always be good?
No, you see, that's what I call the George Bush, Tony Blair theology. Sorry. Where there's the good guys, there's the bad guys. My argument, being the Christian point of view, would be there but for the grace of God go I. I would say there's good and bad in everyone.
Yes.
So, I mean, this all began from you saying that you didn't feel this three-tier idea where the good people go to heaven, the bad people go to hell. It actually represents Christian theology as it's stated in the Bible, and that we're all bad, you said. And from that point of view, none of us deserve heaven.
And we're all good because we're all made in the image of God.
Right.
So we all have this mixture. Mm. And in a sense, what's happening is, how do you get what's bad? Now, you see, I think that one of the problems with what I would call either genetic or social determinism is saying, that's just the way some people are, and there's nothing you can do except lock them up or kill them or whatever. My argument would be, people need to be punished, there needs to be justice and all the rest of it. But, and that brings us back to atonement, which we will get to, I think. But I think there's room for every human being to change at a fundamental level. That experience that you had, I believe that was God showing you something. To me, it was a kind of wake-up call. What he didn't do was give you the whole works all at once. It would be nice if he did. I mean, the Apostle Paul had that, the Damascus Road experience. Yeah. But I suspect even most Christians listening to this would not be able to say, well, I became a Christian on the 4th of July, 1978 or whatever, and that was the precise point. Before that, I was a godless pagan, and then after that, I was the saint. Most of us, it's been a gradual, dare I say it, evolution.
Right. Okay.
Coming back to your experience, Mike, you say you've sort of been looking for that experience ever since and you never found it in the Christian church. I mean, do you feel like if you had that experience again, maybe it's impossible somehow to reproduce such an experience, but if you had it again, that would tell you there really is a God. Now I've had it again, but it wouldn't necessarily answer any of your questions about the nature of that God, whether Christianity is true and all the rest
of
it.
No, I think the difficulty is that my experience doesn't match what I find within a Christian church.
Mm. Okay.
I find great difficulty with the creeds and the dogmas and some of the arguments that the Christian church get themselves involved in over things like homosexuality. Yeah. They get themselves bogged down with the minutiae instead of looking at if the core message is spiritual love through Jesus Christ or through God or through whoever, then that should be the message somehow they're getting across and not getting themselves bogged down in the minutiae. I mean, if I sit there and read out, this is when they read the Bible, which I don't believe is an inerrant document, because I don't think it can be, having been written all those years ago by so many different authors. I find real difficulty with, this is another question you're going to love, the inerrancy of the Bible. I find that.
Can we do a series?
Well, I was going to say, we're going to have a round two, aren't we?
But no, I mean, I find I can't believe the Bible isn't inerrant. And if somebody says to me, this is the word of God, and I straight away, I think to myself, well, is it? Can it be?
Right.
You know.
Okay. Great question. Takes us off in another direction. But ultimately, you found that the things churches talk about and the issues that they're concerned about don't, for you, get to the heart of the matter and certainly don't kind of bring you back to that experience had.
No.
What's Mike missing here, as far as you're concerned, David?
I'm not sure it's something that Mike's missing. It might be something that the churches are missing that he's been to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you why. I don't think that the creeds, for example, are the minutiae. They're the very heart of it. I have a sneaking suspicion that there are a considerable number of churches that say the creeds but don't believe them.
Well, that was one of the things I was going to ask you. How many people sat next to me in pews actually believe it when they read it out?
Yeah. And I would say not only do they say it, and even sometimes people might intellectually believe it, but they don't feel it.
Yes.
And they're not aware of it. So we have, I'm going to teach you as an Englishman, I'm going to teach you a good Scots phrase. Right? You ready for this one?
I'm ready.
It's better felt than telt.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
And I would argue this. I mean, the Thai lady I'm talking about, that I was talking about earlier, she came in. I said, what made you pick this church? She said, well, I went to two or three others, and each time, no, this is not it. This is not it. Mm. Now, she didn't know what it was. Mm. But then she came in and she said, this is it. And, okay, that seems almost entirely subjective. And I would always say to people, be wary, use your head, think, and so on. You can have a feeling. It could just be, you know, bad cheese or something. Or I would say drugs, but I don't want to say that really. You know, it could be any of those things. But actually, our experience is very, very important. And I one of the reasons I became a Christian was I had all the intellectual arguments against, you know, I mean, I would have been on here killing people like me. And I met some Christians who really believed it, and I could see the difference in their life. And when I went to their churches, I thought, nah, this is for real. Now, I could go to church and say, I don't know if this is for real. I don't know if these people really believe it. So I think it's not the minutiae, because particularly, it depends what creed you're talking about, but basics creeds like the Apostles' Creed is who God is. So I think what you're describing, basically, you've had an experience and you're looking for an explanation of it that fits. But more than that, you're looking for the experience again.
Yes.
And I would say, sorry, on you go.
I was just going to say what strikes me is that if I'm in this position, I honestly believe there are hundreds of thousands of people who feel the way I do, that they would love to go to church on a Sunday and be part of the community. Because that's the other thing. It's important to be part of your local community.
Yeah.
And do something for other people without payment. Yeah. That is really, really rewarding. Yeah. And I'd love to go and do that. But because of the formality of the church, is what I believe enough to make me a Christian? That's the core question.
Well,
and it probably isn't.
Well, look, let's go to that question next. We're going to take a quick break, and we're having a really fun chat on the programme today, Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley, and Mike Rand, who's a listener, has been for several years, describes himself as an agnostic, though, and despite being drawn to aspects of Christian faith, has all kinds of questions. He's been putting some of them to David Robertson, our Christian guest on the show today. I'll make sure you can find out more about my guests towards the end of today's show. Do keep listening. We're going to conclude this conversation and hear some of your feedback to recent editions of the show in the next part of today's programme.
Join me, Justin Brierley, Evangelist Jay John, and 10 other inspirational speakers for Unbelievable The Conference 2016. Learn how to become a confident evangelist. Book today at premier.org.uk/discoverevangelism.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Don't forget that Unbelievable exists as a website. You can find us online with lots of links to articles, videos, and much more besides. And this year's conference, of course, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable to avail yourself of that. Looking forward as well to what we're doing next week on the programme. James White is going to be joining me. He's well known as a Calvinist speaker, author, debater out in the States, runs his own podcast there. He's been on a number of times to Unbelievable. He's joining me here in studio for a debate with open theist John E. Sanders. John Sanders is an American theologian who is an open theist. What is open theism? It's a view of God that the future is open. God doesn't necessarily know all future events, the outcome of all future events. We'll be finding out why John believes that, and we'll be asking, is open theism a heresy in as much as it denies the omniscience of God? James White certainly disagrees with it. He'll be here defending a Calvinist review of the sovereignty of God. So look out for that at the same time next week. After today's programme, between 4 and 5, as I mentioned earlier, you can hear The Profile, and two guests will be featuring on The Profile this week. Firstly, Pastor Stefan, a Lebanese pastor, who's seeing many Muslims come to Christ because of the refugee crisis going on their church's doorstep. Find out more from him between 4 and 5. And also, as part of that hour, you'll hear the interview that took place this week with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, on the Inspirational Breakfast Show. So listen out for that, and I hope you can come back next week for Unbelievable as well. We'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's show to the last few weeks of programming.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding our conversation today, why Mike can't quite believe. We've been talking to Mike Rand, listener of Unbelievable for several years, one of the many non-Christians who listens to the programme, says he's drawn to aspects of Christian faith. And if he could, I kind of get the feeling this is what you're saying, Mike, if you could believe, you would believe.
Yeah,
it doesn't sound like you've got sort of a, kind of an aversion to Christianity.
I like to think I've got a really open mind.
Yeah.
Very receptive. Really.
Well, here's David Robertson, also my guest on the programme today, well-known to Unbelievable listeners, Free Church of Scotland moderator, speaker, author, director of the Solar Centre for Public Christianity. David very much in the business of aiming to try and put the rational case for Christianity to people. You like to do it in all kinds of environments. You obviously do the blog, but you've done talks in coffee shops, book clubs and that kind of thing, haven't you, David? What you're hearing from Mike, you say, are the kinds of questions all sorts of people you meet have.
Well, absolutely. I think it resonates. I mean, I think it's not everyone's experience, but Mike, you're absolutely not on your own. In fact, I would suggest that it's not hundreds of thousands. There are millions of people who have the same questions and share your experience. And personally, sometimes I discuss with people, I'm not too empathetic towards them because I think they're just idiots, or their opinions are idiotic, sorry. Right. Or they're just being
better,
silly.
That's better, David.
But I mean, no, they're just, well, in the original Greek sense of the word, but, what I mean by that is they're out for an argument or it's just, they don't care. They get one question answered, they're on to another one. I think here we've already covered a lot of ground, not because you're jumping around all over the place, but because naturally one thing leads on to another.
Yes.
And that's because your questions are real and genuine. And I think it does come back to this to the experience and the connection of truth with that and what is true and what's not true. And in this sense, I'd say the Lord absolutely loves that because he wants people who seek after him in truth. You asked before about... were your beliefs sufficient to make you a Christian? I think they're not. Not yet.
No.
But I think, sorry for using the cliche, but you are on a journey. Mm. One verse I'd thought of when you were saying that was, if you believe in your heart that God raised Jesus from the dead, you're saved. And, it's funny, the amount of belief is very minimal. I can think of two or three people recently who've become Christians. I think of a scientist who actually came to me and said, I don't really have that much problem with God creating the world, providing it happened millions of years ago and involved evolution and so on. He said, that's someone has to have done it. Yeah. That was his basic. He said, I kind of come from nothing. And I don't believe it's unintelligent mind. So he said, as a scientist, and he's a top scientist, he said, I have no problem. He said, my problem is with Jesus. And he mentioned the issue of the cross and the atonement. Now, we got that one sorted. He's recently became a believer and has joined our church and talks about his whole life having been turned upside down. So I pray that for you as well. But do you have that same difficulty with atonement?
The atonement certainly after the Alpha course, was one of my major blocks.
Okay, tell me what the block is there.
Right, there are two blocks, really. Yeah, there's two parts to it. Yeah. The first part is that if you've got a loving, caring, sharing God, which you believe we have, why could he just not forgive the human race anyway?
Okay.
Why sacrifice your only son?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I appreciate that God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit
are one and the same.
But the principle is that if it was his only son, it's quite a barbaric act to be seen to have done. So there's that first question of why do it at all? And the second thing is, if we've evolved over millions and millions of years, which I think you accept, if we've come from single cell creatures into the humans we are today, at what point did Adam and Eve come into the equation? Because if we have evolved, and it appears that we have, it's unlikely that there was ever one particular point when Adam and Eve suddenly became Adam and Eve. So we've gradually evolved into humans. And Adam and Eve...
is there a kind of a sense of that kind of makes it fuzzy as to who exactly needs forgiveness?
If there's no Adam and Eve, Garden of Eden, there can be no original sin.
No kind of fall that there's needs no redeeming. Fall.
And that's, right. I think that's the, for my thinking, that's the key. Okay. If there's no fall and no original sin, then there's nothing for Jesus to lose his life over.
I agree with you.
This will be a quick one to resolve in 10 minutes.
Well, I agree with you, and we won't resolve it in 10 minutes, so you have to come back. We'll have to do this again, because I think the fall is... I agree with you completely. If there's no Adam and Eve, no fall, then the Bible doesn't make sense.
No.
And I believe that there is an Adam and Eve, and there was a fall. I don't think that human beings have evolved over millions of years. I do think that the planet is millions of years old. I think that there is a point. Someone like Derek Kidner would argue that there were humanoids whom God breathed his... spirit into and became human, and there was original couple Adam and Eve. I actually read an article a few years ago saying what they call it, microcondyle Eve or whatever, that basically it was perfectly feasible from a scientific point of view to believe that all human beings evolved. In fact, our genetic similarities are such. So I have no problem. I believe that there was an Adam and Eve. I believe there was a fall. I believe that we're all descended from Adam and Eve. It's why I'm not a racist. I don't believe that any particular race is inferior. And if you were an original Darwinianist, you would have. In fact, Darwin's book was originally subtitled about inferiority of other species or of other races. It was about racial superiority. So I think to be fair, we're not going to be able to go through this in the next 5 minutes or so. So, I mean, we do need, and I would invite you to write me and talk about it. Maybe we will come back and talk about it. For me, the more important question, even more important than that, is the atonement. Now, I think you would understand it better than most people, because you would not like it if you caught a murderer, let's say somebody who killed 3 children, and the judge says, you know what, I forgive you. On you go. You wouldn't like that, would you?
But isn't that what Jesus taught?
No.
Jesus taught forgiveness.
Ah, but he taught forgiveness at a price, and it's an enormous price. Right. Real forgiveness is an enormous price. Remember the man in Northern Ireland, he was actually a Christian, who forgave the IRA for killing his daughter. That wasn't cheap. It wasn't showmanship. It was a real price that he paid. I think forgiveness comes at a price. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, I'm going to show off with a bit of French, said... Le Dieu me pardonne parce que c'est son métier. God will pardon me because that's his job. If you believe that, you can go out and do what you want. There's no justice. And you said God is loving and caring and sharing and so on, and I agree with that. But if he's not just, he cannot be God.
Right.
So we've got to have justice. So then the question becomes, how do you have justice, deal with evil, and yet save people?
But the difficulty is with justice, you've got somebody who's lived a perfect life, the Son of God,
Jesus Christ,
who suffers the most barbaric death.
Yeah.
Where's the justice in that?
Ah, here's the justice of it. I get fined, and let's say I'm caught speeding, which has happened a couple of times. It's just that I get fined. If someone pays my fine for me, the court will still accept that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just. And I mean, that's a trivial example. But I think Christ died in our place. He took our punishment. He took our sin. For me, the greatest thing is this. When someone comes to me and says, David, you're a scumbag, I'm going, you know, you're right. But thankfully, Jesus died for me. And that doesn't mean to say, I then think, okay, that's good, I can go out and commit sin. Actually, if I believed what you have just said, that God will forgive me whatever, then I can go and do whatever I want. But I don't believe that. I believe that I've got to answer to God on the day of judgment. I do think, you know, whatever you believe about
Adam and Eve, how do you imagine that will work?
I think it will just simply be, the Bible uses a picture, and I think it is a picture, I don't think it's a literal one, which says the books are opened. Here's everything you've ever done.
So you would actually go with the ledger that I talked about?
Well, I wouldn't call it a ledger. What I would call it was a record of every single one of my internet transactions.
Right.
which I'm not able to wipe clean. Right. So, you know, if I mean,
you can't clear your history as you can.
Yeah.
On the
well, it's like with you know, you go and forgive the advert, but you go on Google or something, or you're on YouTube, and let's say you happen to click onto something, you know, some sexual thing, within a day, what will be happening is other sexual stuff will come up on your advert because it's got your history. You think, oh no, I don't want that. I didn't. It was an accident. I didn't mean to do that. You know, honest. You know, and I think that God is so great that he has a record of everything that we've ever said and done. Jesus himself said, we will be judged for every word that we've said. Interesting that he said word as well, because words are important. And I think that the idea of God judging sin and forgiving sin at the same time, it's only the cross that makes sense of that. Otherwise, you have a God who's not just, or you have a God who can't forgive.
Right.
And to me, that's the difference.
Certainly the God of the Old Testament with...
you bring up that one now?
Well, I won't go into that. But they appear, from a layman's point of view, to be different gods almost, because you've got the God of love and the God who would be prepared to wipe out whole races who happen to oppose the Israeli
people. And yet in the New Testament, the God of the Old Testament doesn't talk about hell. In the New Testament, Jesus does.
Yes.
All human beings are going to... So
do you envisage a hell?
Yes, I do.
Right.
Because I believe in justice. And
so how do you think that... How will that work? I mean...
Oh, my goodness.
We're covering about 10 shows.
How do I think it will work is this. I have to think within certain parameters, okay, because I don't know everything.
Right.
So all of us have a framework with which we think. I mean, I'm trying to challenge your framework, I think, a little bit. I think God's already challenged it, actually. I think that experience you had has shattered your framework. But my framework is this. God, to be God, has to be perfectly just and perfectly loving. Therefore, he cannot do anything that's unjust. If I perceive something as unjust, it's my perception and lack of understanding. I'm not all-knowing, despite the way that I come across sometimes. You know, I'm not. I mean, the more I know, the more I realize what I don't know. And that brings me all the way back to the person of Christ. And therefore, the question of the God of the Old Testament, the Jesus of the New, I see them as the same. That doesn't mean to say there aren't difficult passages, but I find difficult passages in the New Testament as well. So, you know... Sorry, this sounds ridiculous, but I actually want to give you this. It's a magnificent obsession. It's a book I wrote about Jesus.
How much is it?
It's free.
It's
like the gospel. It's free from a Scotsman. That's amazing.
That's
an evidence of grace.
Yeah, okay.
And for those because you can't see what happened, David did literally just hand the book over to Mike here in studio.
And it deals with a lot of those questions because, please understand me, I really really mean this. Mike, honestly, I mean this. The questions you're asking are the absolute key questions. Justin's not joking either. We could have 20 programs on these questions. Yes. They are the key ones. And I would just encourage you to keep seeking. And for me, I want to keep pointing to Jesus and say, you know, ultimately you will find all the answers in him. They just won't be as neat and tidy as...
Can I just get one in? You're probably going to run out of time.
Go on then.
But
go
very
on then.
Quickly.
Final one.
Yeah. The final one is... The Bible says that the only way is through Jesus.
Yeah.
Mm. How can that possibly be right when we've got staunch Jewish people, staunch Muslims, all believing in God?
Very, very quickly.
Very quick. I know that's a whole show as well.
I'm going to go from here to Sunningdale for a church conference. I meet somebody who says, "Nah, the way to Sunningdale, what you do is you get on a ferry and go over at Hull," and someone else says, "No, you get a train up to Scotland." Right. And I turn around and say, well, someone says, "No, this is the way you go. You go to, you know, get a train into Kent or whatever, or Surrey, wherever it is." And I say, "Oh, don't be so arrogant." All these different ways. My argument would be in every religion contains some truth, but all religions are useless without Christ. I would say a lot of you...
Why, though?
Because it's only through Christ we get to know God. And therefore,
that's only one verse in John's Gospel, isn't it?
No. I think it's the whole emphasis of the Bible. And here's, I think, part of your problem. I think lots of churches are just religious and have left Jesus out.
Oh, well, that's probably right.
I think that's why people get so confused. Mm. Now, you get people who talk about Jesus all the time and are legalistic and hard and all the rest of it. I honestly believe that Jesus is merciful. I personally, in my own church, I've seen people from more than 20 different countries become Christians, many different backgrounds. My neighbors are Muslims. They are fine, fine people. But I don't think their religion will save them. In fact, I think it's a torture for them. And I hope and pray that they'll come to know Jesus. I don't want them to become Christians in the sense of religious.
See, I've got real difficulty with that because to me, God isn't a Christian. God is God.
Well, exactly. But the way to God is through Christ. I mean, there are people.
It can't be the only way, surely.
Well, why not? Because there are lots of. I mean, 2 and 2 is 4. That cannot be the only answer. Well, yeah, it can be. I think if the answer is big enough, it can be. And I think Jesus is big enough.
We're going to have to leave it there, guys.
Yeah. Okay, that's
I'm really sorry to, because I could have gone on all day, and maybe we should do a round two at some point when we're both back. We'll see where you're at next time.
Okay.
Anyway, Mike.
That'd be great.
Really kind of you to come in and just sort of pose the questions and tell us about your journey in the honest way you have. And
thank you very much. And it's been a great pleasure to meet you both.
It gave lots for David to get excited about as well.
Mike, honestly, seriously, who's the comedian we did?
Oh, when we did, Marcus
Brigstock.
Brigstock.
Yeah, Marcus Brigstock. We got Marcus Brigstock.
That was a few
honestly,
years ago.
You and Marcus Brigstock are my two favourite shows.
Thank you very much.
It has been an absolute joy to meet you. Okay, and indeed. Forgive me for saying, I will pray for you and come back to me with these questions. I've put my, please contact me in the book.
Okay.
And,
You're on his hit list. You're on the prayer list.
Yeah, you're on the prayer list.
All right. Great. Thanks, guys. Mike Rand and David Robertson joined me today. If you want more about David, solus-cpc.org.uk. And any links for you, Mike?
Just through yourself, if you like.
Okay.
That'd be great.
All right. Well, lovely to have you both in the studio with me for today's edition of Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Thanks to everyone who's been in touch over the last week. And I always get more emails than I can read out. So apologies if you've sent one in and I haven't had a chance to read it out. Just a quick reminder that if you're interested in finding out more information about this year's conference, we've got some great speakers coming. Tanya Walker, who we heard from last week on the programme. Jeremiah J. Johnston is the head of the Christian Thinkers Society. They're partnering with us for this year's Unbelievable Conference. People like Gary Habermas are going to be present. He's a brilliant apologist, a New Testament scholar, talking about the resurrection at this year's conference. And Jay John is one of our key guests as well, and he's a prolific evangelist here in the UK, going to be delivering some really practical down-to-earth advice on how you can share your faith effectively. And a bunch of other guests as well. Looking forward to having some of the guys and girls from the UK Apologetics Network presenting on a couple of issues as well. So lots to choose from this year at Unbelievable, the conference. Do go to the website to find out more. Saturday, 2nd of July, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016. Thanks to Robert, who's been in touch to say, I'm a devout listener to Unbelievable. Was really intrigued by the 2 megachurch comparison show you did a couple of weeks ago. Your show, one of the very few I look forward to every week. That said, my favourite have always been the debates with a bit of heat. Robertson versus Dillahunty is my number one. I've probably listened to both parts 5 times at least. At the very end of the programme, Matt, as all atheists eventually do when it comes down to it, says that even if God exists, he'd consider him an immoral thug with inferior intellect. David retorts that that's a whole other show. Please consider having that show. I'd love that debate. And while I know it's been done before, having those two go at it would be such ear candy. Anyway, just a thought. Thank you very much, Rob. I hope you enjoyed today's show anyway. Obviously, less, if you like, combative, obviously, than the Matt Dillahunty exchange that David Robertson had getting on for a couple of years ago now. But appreciate you emailing in. Lots of stuff still coming in about those Borkum and Ehrman debates of a couple of weeks ago. I'll see if I can get to some of that. But firstly, some of your responses to last week's show. Peter Singer, well-known atheist ethicist, was in conversation with Richard Weikart, a Christian historian, on whether there is an intrinsic value to human life. Susan Blackmore, also an atheist philosopher and psychologist, joined the conversation too. So this came in just a few comments on Facebook. First of all, Ian Barnett caught the last bit, says the trouble with the nonsense that Susan Blackmore came out with is that she denies intrinsic human value on the one hand, then depends on it to justify her own moral viewpoint. She's sad at all the death in human conflicts. Well, based on what? The value of those lost lives? And the comment about us making progress culturally. On what basis does she evaluate progress? On some moral basis? Doesn't that require that there is intrinsic value in life? But she denied it, and purpose, and yet invoked both. Douglas Davies, again on Facebook, says, particularly sad to hear Susan support abortion on the fact that unwanted pregnancies increase suffering. It's logical by her position
that to ultimately solve the issue of suffering means to end all life on Earth. Without life, there can be no suffering. Life is full of pain, especially in poor families and poor countries. Susan and Peter should head up the Happiness Council and oversee the extermination of suffering people. Dwayne Howard on Facebook says, I really think it's time to do an Unbelievable episode dedicated to the notion of intrinsic value, since almost all discussions involving morality on this show between believers and atheists end up as a debate about intrinsic value or intrinsic meaning. I think this discussion would be useful because I'm very puzzled by the notion that something has intrinsic value. I'm puzzled because when I look around, I see that things only have a value in as much as we assign value to them. For example, gold has a value to us because we assign a certain economic value to it. Gold is just a metal. It doesn't have any value until we give it value. It's the same with everything in life. Human value is valuable to us, but is it valuable to other species? Do birds value human life? What does it mean to say that human life is intrinsically valuable? Valuable to who or what? Says that commentator. Stephen Paul, on the other hand, says, I think I would have difficulty doing my job if I didn't have the framework of appreciating the intrinsic nature of human life. And I think, Paul, you're a psychologist yourself. Well, when I see a person, I'm not counting everything they've done to determine if their life is valuable. No, they are a person. They are automatically valuable in my book. So let's see what we can do to make it better, to make sense of what's happening, to find meaning, to keep on living. Just my two cents. And always, as always, thank you for all you do, Justin. Thank you very much. So just a few of the comments that came in when I posted that to the Facebook page of Unbelievable. You can find that at facebook.com/unbelievablejb. Lots of people emailing in their thoughts on the back of that as well. Joe says, thank you for the consistently high standard of the debates on the programme. Big fan. Comment on Singer's view that we can defend the morality of an action based on it maximising pleasure and minimising pain. I haven't heard this particular argument before, but would like to know what you think about it. As a thought experiment to test whether Singer's assertion holds water or whether his personal morality is really based on the assertion, let's imagine a horrific scenario where there's another Holocaust in the next 100 years, where instead of 6 million Jewish people being exterminated, there are 20 million of the by then larger Jewish community wiped out. Would Singer then be able to say the Nazis would have been performing a moral good if they had managed to completely wipe out the Jewish people in World War II? It would have prevented greater suffering or maximized pleasure by preventing greater suffering in the long run. The thought experiment can be adjusted to increase the amount of eventual suffering. What if it was 100 million people and so on? Is there any level of maximizing pleasure or minimizing pain that would make an evil act good? I don't believe so. And I don't think Singer really does either. Well, the view that Singer holds, a sort of utilitarian view, has been around for a long time in ethics, and all sorts of thought experiments have been proposed that often seem to throw into question the ethics of that way of approaching things. And that's just another one, I suppose. Thank you for getting in touch. Let's see if we can rush through a couple more. Mike Russ says, as always, enjoyed this week's show. Find with all of these discussions that people can justify almost anything in theory, but I'm afraid that if Peter Singer and or Susan Blackmore had to follow their theories to their logical conclusions, that we would begin to see very significant flaws. I'd like to see more flesh and bone in the discussion. For example, I've always wanted to ask a pro-choice person the real life question. My wife and I lost a baby in 2004 at 24 weeks into our pregnancy. We held him. His name was Matthew Thomas Russ. We had a funeral and buried him in a cemetery. The question, did we lose a child or not? The answer has huge worldview implications. My guess is that pro-choicers would be quick to say it's not yet a baby in theory, but slow to tell that to a grieving mother. Also wanted to reach out to you. One of my close friends is Edward Fudge, the author of The Fire That Consumes. I'd recommend you have him on the show. He's one of the most significant voices for conditional immortality. Yes, I'm aware of that. Thank you, Mike. And it would be good to get Edward Fudge himself on the programme. And finally, another Mike says, commenting on, is human life intrinsically valuable? Richard Vicart is against euthanasia because he wants to impose his religious beliefs on others. But what about people that believe euthanasia can save lives? I'm talking about people that believe in cryonics, the practice of freezing your body for future resuscitation. They believe that euthanasia will improve cryonics. I also don't like the fact that Richard thinks morality is pointless without God. Isn't it just possible that we as individuals create our own meaning and morality? Everyone has their own worldviews, their own beliefs, their own opinions, their own morality. Yeah, well, that was what was obviously being debated. But the question, I suppose, being, does that mean that human value is therefore subjective and could change? You know, that we don't regard people as valuable if they don't have certain things that we think they should have. Is a disabled person less valuable than a completely able-bodied person, for instance? There is a question there about how we
assign this value. And obviously on a Christian worldview, that if you're a human, that means you're made in the image of God. That means you have this value, which is not dependent on any other factor other than you being human in that sense. Thank you for all of the comments. We have run out of time. I didn't get to the Bar M and Richard Borkham ones. Perhaps we'll try and make more time for those last week, because as I say, they're still coming in. But appreciate everyone who gets in touch with the programme, and do keep doing that if you can. Do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk or equally via the social media. It's been a fun conversation today on the programme, so I'd like to hear your thoughts on it as well. And hope that you come back for the same thing at the same time next week here on the programme that aims to get you thinking.
You're unbelievable.
We're asking next week, is open theism a heresy? It's a view that God doesn't necessarily know the future. We're going to be hearing it defended by John E. Sanders. James White, who's a Calvinist, will be taking him on that. One for the theologians, but one for everyone, hopefully, to enjoy as well, because we're going to be certainly making it as accessible as possible. Hope you can join me for that same time, same place next week. Until then, have a good week.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams July Summer Sale and get 30% off paints and stains July 18th through the 28th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.